Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today we come to you from the great land down under, Australia, via the miracle of Skype. Thank you, Skype, wherever you are. My guest, who happens to live in the Southern Hemisphere, is Professor Denis Dragovich, a scholar and practitioner of post-conflict state building. He has worked for over a decade with various UN agencies and non-governmental organizations in conflict environments from the Middle East to Africa and to Asia, both as a country director and a technical specialist, including having led one of the largest aid programs in Iraq. He holds a PhD in political theology from the University of St. Andrews in the United Kingdom. In addition to a bevy of scholarly and policy-based publications, he is the author of the new book, Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, Roman Catholic and Sunni Islamic Perspectives, out with Palgrave this year. In addition, Denis is a regular commentator in the media on the Middle East and in particular on the Islamic State. And when he is not doing all this writing and appearing in the media, he is donning his Superman cape and rescuing hostages in Iraq, a story that we will ask him about here in a minute. Of course, all this info is posted on our website, so mosey on over and check us out at www.researchonreligion.org, because we would love to see you there, even though we really can't see you on the website, but we know you are there. Denis, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, and good afternoon from Australia.
Yeah, first off, I have to ask you, because you are the first guest to live and call from Australia. We've had two other Aussie guests before, but they were up here in Seattle at the time. And it's actually Thursday where you live, even though it is only Wednesday evening here. So the obvious question that I have, and I've always been curious about this, what does the future look like? Is it so bright that I got to wear shades?
Well, I tell you what, why don't I look at the racing results and I'll send them over to you.
Oh, that would be so good. Yeah, we could make a mint doing that. One of the things I always know out here in Seattle, we're one of the last ones to celebrate New Year's Eve, and I know Australia is always one of the first ones. So I get up in the early morning and watch you guys celebrate and then basically watch it turn over for another 24 hours. One of the other things that I teased in the introduction is that you were instrumental in helping release a hostage that was held in Iraq, and I've never had a guest like that before. There has to be a great story here. So fill us in on that. What happened?
Oh, absolutely. So I was the country director for an NGO in Iraq at the time. This was early 2004, and the situation was rapidly deteriorating. The security situation had just basically fallen apart. And leading up to the early 2000s, as charity workers, you could pretty much go anywhere you like in Africa or the Middle East, wave the white flag, and people would understand that that means neutrality, independence, and you would be largely left alone. But what's happened since, I would say probably since 2001 and the invasion of Afghanistan and the attacks on New York and Washington, that there has been a perception of Western aid as being politicized. And so one of my staff was kidnapped by militants in Iraq, and it took 10 days of negotiations, going down rabbit holes, chasing individuals and groups to find out who had him. And eventually then also to find a way to get him out. At that stage, we didn't want to engage with the military or the police. We really wanted to use back channels, and it succeeded.
Yeah. Well, that's a good story. I mean, the first time, though, that you heard the news, tell us about those first few minutes. Most people, you don't live a life where somebody comes up and says, hey, some of your staff workers have just been kidnapped.
Well, it was midnight, and I knew the situation was turning sour. I was in Baghdad at the time, but this individual was down in Najaf, which is the holy city for Shia Islam in Iraq. It's home to the mosque of Imam Ali. And I had lived there for several months before, and so I was being fed this information that the situation was deteriorating. Now, I had told this young individual, I'd said, I'm going to move you to a safe house that no one else is going to know where it is other than the owner of the house and you and me. And I went to bed that night thinking, all's good, he's safe, I'm safe, we can go to sleep that night. I get a call at midnight, basically one of my staff, who's the owner of the safe house, said, this gentleman's being kidnapped. And I said, how? We put him in the safe house. As it turns out, he thought he knew better. He left the safe house and he went back to his house where he had things that could keep him occupied, keep him busy. And a few hours after he had left the safe house, he got kidnapped. 19 armed men came with RPGs and machine guns, confronted him and took him away. So on the final day when we got him out, the first thing he said to me over the phone was, Dennis, I will listen to everything you say from now on.
Yeah, that is some lesson to learn, I guess. I don't know if he's going back to play Xbox or whatever it might have been, but always listen to your superiors. And when they say safe house, I'm usually down with that. I mean, yeah, safe house. I love safe houses. How did the negotiations come about? You said it took 10 days. Did you have to meet shady characters in hotel lobbies or back alleyways?
No. See, in this situation, he appeared on the news, has become ubiquitous now with the men clad in black with machine guns and machetes. He appeared on a news stream like that on day three. And so since that moment in time, we were looking, well, who's got him? We didn't even know who had him. We had suspicions. We had heard rumors. And so it was really getting the word out in and amongst our network that we are humanitarian, we are not pushing a particular agenda and a particularly a religious agenda, because that was a real concern of people in Iraq at the time, that all civilians were associated with some sort of Christian attitude that they were trying to promulgate. So it was really working the back channels to get to the people who had him. And I think we did get to the right people, because one of the letters I sent to the group that I thought had him was suggesting that they play the humanitarian role, that they intervene between the group that had him, which I thought was the same group as to whom I was writing to, but I, you know, making them, giving them an out of all of this situation. And so that's how it ended up. Muqtada al-Sadr, who's a famous, well-known name now, intervened as the humanitarian go-to guy who solved this situation. I suspect, though, he had his hand in it, though.
Well, it turns out that was a happy ending, and I'm glad to hear that. And I can imagine you didn't get very much sleep those 10 days.
No. Fascinating life experience.
Well, that is something that happens in states that are falling apart and when there's a lot of chaos and anarchy about. And that's what we want to talk about today. Our objective is to dive into your new book, which is called Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, Roman Catholic and Sunni Islamic Perspectives. And that sounds like a pretty ambitious book, considering that state building is really a major topic in the study of political science. I want to start out, though, with some definitional terms so that we get everybody on the same page. I'm a political scientist, so I got some feel for this, but not many listeners are out there. In the opening pages of your work, you talk about state failure and then move on to state building. Please define those terms for us.
Well, fair enough. Let me first of all begin with this idea. What is common, I find, with U.S. scholars is this idea that conflating nation building and state building. So it's really important to and nation state and state and nation. I think it's really important to begin there. Not all states are nations and not all nations are states. And it's a particular thing with American media and scholarship that I really don't understand why. But there are some nations of people such as the Kurds or the Catalans, who are have a common history, culture, language, but they don't have a state. And then there are states that don't necessarily encompass a particular nation of people. And this, I guess you could say, would be common to a lot of the post-colonial borders that were drawn up around the world, where particular tribes and communities were divided on one side of a border and another side of the border. So when we talk about, or at least when I talk about state failure, it is the failure of the institution of the state as opposed to what is the longer-term nation-building processes that have very often been considered historically, looking at how particular nations have developed and evolved. And so state building, the way I begin with it, is trying to reverse engineer state failure. So if we understand how states fail, then we can look at what are the constituent blocks that required to have states rebuilt, in a sense. And so what I've done is I've drawn on the works of political scientists who have looked at this issue and tried to then pull out from them what the critical pieces are. But just to give examples, some specific examples, if we're talking about state failure, Syria currently today, Somalia over more than a decade, Libya since a few years ago, 2011, Afghanistan certainly prior to 2001 and the latter stages of the Taliban's occupation. These are examples of what we would call as failed states or states failing states.
And how would you define that if I had to find a failing state? You listed, I mean, Somalia is a pretty easy one. It just seems to be complete chaos there. But you mentioned Syria and Afghanistan during the Taliban time. It seemed like the Taliban were holding things together a little bit. Why would that be considered a failed state?
Right. Well, there's a bit of an argument amongst political scientists over this. Some say states fail as a result of a legitimacy failure, and others will say it results as because of institutional failure. So legitimacy failure would be most clearly, I can give the example of Gaddafi's Libya, where as far as human development indicators and the functionality of the state itself, it was very successful. It had human development indicators that were far better than most of the rest of Africa. And yet, there came a point in time where Gaddafi's regime collapsed. And that would be the prime candidate for people who argue for legitimacy failure, because in the eyes of the people in the international community, Gaddafi's regime lost legitimacy. The other example is institutional failure, and this is when the institutions of the state themselves can no longer deliver the services that are required for a functioning society. And so these are ranked often by different authors, but in general we can say that the primary requirements are security and stability is one, and the provision of basic needs. And then there are other economic development, good governance, etc., that can be seen as basic requirements for a state, but those two are the critical ones. And so what I do is I borrow from these authors and I say, I'm not going to get involved in this debate. What I'm going to look at is both legitimacy and institutional failure and bring them together and call it three primary elements for state building. And that is we need legitimacy, we need security, and we need basic needs. And that's the basic building block from which I begin at looking at state building.
I can imagine that there's an interconnectedness between legitimacy and the institutions. If the institutions start failing and can't deliver the basic needs and especially cannot deliver security, legitimacy is probably soon to collapse thereafter. And I could also see, though, that even if a country does deliver the basic needs and some degree of security, and Libya might be an example of this, it still just isn't legitimate. And one might be wondering if, you know, regimes such as, you know, perhaps Iran might be in that situation today. There's a lot of indications that there is unhappiness with the regime, but, you know, they're still delivering the basic goods, basically.
That's right. And so the way I take it is I'm saying it's two sides of the same coin. Now, that's just bringing them together. We can't say it's this in particular or it's not that. I'm saying let's look at all three of them. And it could be interrelated in certain circumstances or it may not be in other circumstances.
So you're a scholar on this, but you're also a practitioner. And you mentioned there's three areas that you're looking into: legitimacy, security, and the basic needs. So how do you go about doing that? Do you set up a plan at first? Do you order a kit from Lego and start putting the bricks together? How does one take a state that looks like it's failing or perhaps is failed and put it back together?
Well, from a practitioner's perspective, it's very much looking at sad to say, but it is driven by budgets. It's driven by the institution that you work within. It is a functionalist approach. So the United Nations Office for Refugees has, High Commissioner for Refugees has a particular mandate. It only works within that mandate. And so to give you an example, though, of how this can become problematic, when the international community first prepared to respond to Iraq in 2003, the fear was that there would be mass displacement. And so the agencies that deal with displacement within the U.S. government, Bureau of Population Refugee Migration, BPRM, and internationally, it's International Organization of Migration and UNHCR. So these were the organizations that were mobilized. They had partners themselves who delivered programs who were technically organizationally prepared to respond to displacement. The problem was there was no displacement. And so we were in a situation in early 2003. I came in June 2003, a few months after the initial invasion, where you had contracts, you had money and staffing all structured around the idea that it would be a mass displacement humanitarian crisis, but it wasn't. And so this is part of the practitioner's challenge in dealing with state failure is if it's immediately after a conflict, you don't know how the conflict will play out. You don't know where the needs will be, and that makes it very difficult. Now, from a scholarly perspective, what I tried to do was to say, okay, let's first of all begin on a theoretical plane. We've got the three basic building blocks, primary elements of state building, legitimacy, security, and basic needs. And what then I was looking at was to say, okay, from the perspective of different organizations, whether it's tribal groups, unions, religious institutions, corporations, it doesn't matter. Every group can contribute one way or another or influences one way or another those three basic building blocks. So charities will certainly contribute to basic needs. Tribes will probably, in most circumstances, contribute to security. Corporations or unions may contribute to basic needs. They may also contribute to legitimacy. But I specifically started looking at religion and how religious institutions would contribute to those three. They're the building blocks that I began with.
I want to pick that up in a little bit here and talk about specifically about religion, because it's something that we talked with John Reese in terms of economic development a few weeks back, and we will link back to that podcast. But in terms of just general state building, actually, I'm interested in what happened in 2003 in Iraq. You said, we're all ready for a big displacement of individuals here. There's going to be a massive migration. We got the resources in place. I guess these might be tents and water systems and things like that. And nothing happens. What did you do then? Did you just sit there and wait for people to come, or did you take those resources and somehow retool them in a different direction?
Well, you first of all look for contract modifications that allow you then to expand who your clients or beneficiaries will be. You have to be also very cautious in those circumstances what you do, because you can actually make the situation worse. Because in the Africa context, when there's displacement, usually then there are camps. And you see that now in the Middle East for people displaced from Syria, huge camps are established. But in Iraq, what happened, it was the community itself who integrated and took on the responsibility of catering for the needs of people who were displaced. So no camps were established, but rather families' households increased in size because they all traveled to a relative or a distant cousin or friend or something like that. And now if you've got contracts that are specifically targeted to support only displaced people, because you can't just willy-nilly decide where you want to send the money, you have to abide by your contractual obligations, it becomes problematic that you would give some support or provide some sort of engagement to an individual within a household who is displaced and not to their host or not to their cousin who is not displaced but equally in need. And this can range, I can just, let's say, a practical example, anywhere from making microfinance available only to displaced people, which would be terrible thing to do, through to the more immediate programmatic response, which is the provision of non-food item kits. They're called NFI kits, so maybe a toothbrush, toothpaste, a blanket, other utensils. If you give that only to one individual, and yet people are in equal need but simply haven't been displaced, it can actually cause more problems than solve. And so this is where the mechanics of aid delivery become very difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine the bureaucratic rules that you might have to deal with. I think that would drive me crazy. I mean, I would just go in there and say, oh, you know, we need to distribute these NFI kits, these folks crowding into their relatives' house. Oh, looks like a lot of people need these toothpaste and other amenities kits. I'd give it to them, but then I'd probably get in trouble.
Well, I mean, but in that circumstance, you're presuming you have access to unlimited resources.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
the point
true.
Is you've only got a limited amount of money and you have to decide to whom does it go.
Yeah. One other question I have about this before we move on to religion, and this is interesting. You mentioned it a little bit in context with the hostage situation that you had to deal with before. But when it comes to state building and assisting that process, who does it really come down to in terms of responsibility? And how do some nations, some people from certain nations or from citizens in a country, can separate those two types of groups out, respond to outsiders coming in and saying, hi, we're here to rebuild your state?
Well, I can answer that again from a practitioner and an academic perspective. From the academic perspective, this is where it becomes really interesting. State building sits firmly within the literature of international relations. And so it is very much biased to actions of international organizations. The focus is on foreign countries, international or multinational institutions, and how they then input their resources and expertise to rebuild a country. Now, in reality, having been a practitioner in these situations, I'm very, very aware that actually that those elements play a very small role, unless there is a situation such as in Iraq, where the United States took over the mandate of governance. And it became, in effect, the responsibility of a country of the United States, which is very rare. In most cases, the international actors are contributing to a state-building process that is driven from within. And what we tend to do, because the literature sits within IR, is ignore the local players. We ignore the role that trade unions, corporations, local businessmen, courts, and all these other bodies can contribute simply because of how the disciplines within academia are split.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you on that one. And that brings us to the next question of one of the grassroots organizations that does matter here are religious groups, religious organizations. And I want you to talk a little bit about how you came to investigate in this topic and write this book on religion and post-conflict state building, because I can say this, and I know John Reese has said this in a previous podcast, that religion and international relations, religion and comparative politics, religion and state building, nobody really looks at that stuff.
No, you're right. My path, my journey began with a particular meeting that I remember very clearly. So I was, like I mentioned, in Iraq in 2003. I was living in Najaf, the holy city full of Ayatollahs within the Shia Islam. And the Americans sent a gentleman called Ambassador Robert Ford, who was the head of the governorate of Najaf, or became the representative of the central authority of the U.S. Transitional administration. And I had the opportunity to sit down with him and have a chat. And I asked him, are you going to be meeting with the Ayatollahs in the coming months? And he clearly said to me, he said, no, we won't be, because we're looking at establishing a secular, centralized state.
That's not going to go over well.
No. And I was, we were talking about, 12 years ago. Yeah. I was naive, unaware of the broader dynamics. I thought it sounded silly and short-sighted, but who was I to say? And so I went along with it, and so be it. I was visiting their Ayatollahs constantly because my life and security depended on it, and the effectiveness of our activities depended on it. But that stayed at the back of my mind. And then as the years progressed, certainly the U.S. and the efforts of General Petraeus seemed to recognize and acknowledge the role that religion played, tribes played, local dynamics played. Now, a lot of academia already knew that. A lot of historians already knew that. But for whatever reason, it wasn't in the policy field. It just wasn't being engaged with. And so that's what drove me to work on this topic, which is effectively to develop a model of how to consider the role of religious institutions in post-conflict state building.
And I guess for me, it seems really obvious. I've been working in this field for 25 some odd years or so, starting with my dissertation. And I understand that religious groups, churches, mosques, imams, all these different folks play a very important role in their community. They organize people, they bring people together, they give people direction, people look to them for solace in times of difficulty. It just seems that it would be odd that policymakers would turn a blind eye to a set of institutions that are just so good at organizing folks.
It is surprising me also. And I think there's a lot to be researched in that why does that happen? How is it that policymakers could overlook such an important institution? But it's not only policymakers, though. When I was doing research on this topic and going through what the World Bank or what other scholars have written, when they do talk about civil society and what comprises civil society, inevitably it ignores religion. There is always a long list of this type of body and this type of group, but never is religion included. And I found that fascinating. There's a little bit of research that talks about how religion is ignored by – it's a mental taboo. That's mm-hmm. the terminology used by one scholar, a mental taboo that's not to be talked about. It's not to be included. And that's – I find that fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, you're just describing my life over the last 25 years. I hear you on that. And that's part of the reason why we bring you research on religion, because this podcast is designed to be a little bit of a corrective to that. And so it's wonderful talking to you about this. And, you know, it goes back to Robert Putnam, right, about bowling leagues. And I'm saying there's churches. We're churches in your book. So, but talking about that, you talk about the importance of religious institutions, and like as I mentioned in the introduction, you're dealing with the Middle East. You told us some stories here already in Iraq. You've been in Africa and also in Asia. The religious institutions are going to be kind of different here. So when we talk about religious institutions, or when you talk about it in your book, what do you mean by religious institutions? Who are these folks? What are they?
Yeah, so I had to narrow that down, obviously, because the title of the book is Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, which was more probably driven by the publishers than by myself. Yeah. And then I'm looking at religious institutions, and even those we have to narrow down. So an institution itself, I borrowed the work of a gentleman called Guy Peters, who studies this idea of institutions. And basically, there are three critical aspects that I try to draw upon when I'm looking at what whether a religious institution is an institution in and of itself. And they are. There has to be some stability over time. It can't be just an organization that comes and goes, and there is no aspect of an institution to it. It has to be able to influence individual behavior. It's not as if it is just inwardly focused in of itself. And the last aspect is that it has a sense of shared values and a meaning amongst its members, that there are some values that it stands for that you can objectively put aside and separate to the individuals that make up or constitute its membership. So when we transpose that into the space of religion, I'm looking at religious institutions that have a national standing, so not small churches that may be in particular corners of a particular country, but because we're looking at state building at a state level, we need to look at similarly religious institutions at a state level. So, for example, there are some institutions such as the Roman Catholic Church, which is the obvious institution. But then when it comes to Sunni Islam, it becomes a little bit more hard to ascertain, well, where is the institution in Sunni Islam? Because Sunni Islam, if you had to compare its structures, it would be a lot more closer to Protestantism, where there is a closer and a direct interpretation of the scriptures without the need of an intermediary institution. And so with Sunni Islam, in some countries, like Bosnia and Herzegovina, there is actually an institution, a registered, structured institution that represents Sunni Islam in that country. In other countries, you may not have a formal institution, but the government will acknowledge a Grand Mufti, or which will then have a structure behind it. So it would be a sort of a government-acknowledged and recognized body. Even in some cases, I would go as far as saying some individuals can be seen as institutions in of themselves, in that their teachings have transcended the individual opinions and have become a part of a country's culture. So there are some people who are just larger than life to such a degree that they are seen as institutions by people. So it really varies depending on the location, on the particular culture, and on the religion as to what is the religious institution to be studied.
Now, in terms of talking about all the different actors that could play a role in state building, and you mentioned corporations and unions and other groups as well. And if I asked you to put a weight on religious institutions, and obviously this is going to vary by country, I would imagine, is the role of churches, or religious institutions of primary importance? Is it a complementary importance? How would you weight that?
You're right to say that it varies from country to country, but when we're looking at state failure, inevitably the institutions that are functioning following the collapse of a state, one of them will be a religious institution. It is by the very nature of humanity that when circumstances confront us, existential circumstances, we tend to turn to religion. And based on that, religious institutions will tend to be functioning, robust, and influential within communities faced by state failure.
And that, in and of itself, should be a big, huge warning light to scholars to pay attention to it. Religions have existed for eons, and when a state fails, those religious institutions are still around. It just amazes me nobody figures that out.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.